Stories, fables, ghostly tales, the podcast.
The first sign that something was wrong wasn't a scream. It was a window. On the morning of 28th June 1967, on Britannia Road in Easton, Bristol, neighbours realised something that should have been impossible to miss. Louisa Dunn hadn't been seen. Not in the doorway, not in the street, not in the little moments of daily life that told everyone quietly that she was still there. And then someone noticed it. A window, unusually open. It's the kind of detail that sounds almost meaningless until you imagine it on a street where people knew each other's rhythms, where a missing face wasn't just someone having a lie-in. It was a disruption in the street's heartbeat. That window was a question, hanging in the air. A neighbor went inside the house at 58 Britannia Road and found Louisa dead. She had been raped. She had been killed. And for nearly six decades, the person who did it wasn't just unknown. He was unpunished. So, today's story is about one moment of violence in 1967, and the long, quiet stretch of time after it, where a community carried the memory, a family carried the grief, and a case file sat in storage, waiting for the future to finally learn how to read what the past had preserved. This is a story about a woman who mattered, not because she became a headline, but because she was a person with a long life behind her. A home, a history, friendships, routines, and a community that noticed her absence. And it's a story about how justice can move like a glacier. Slow, heavy, and sometimes so late it feels almost unreal when it finally arrives. Because the twist in this case isn't an unexpected suspect. The twist is that the evidence was there. A trace on a skirt, a print on a window. But the world in 1967 didn't have the tools to translate that trace into a name. And when that translation finally happened, it didn't only identify a man. It forced an entire city to look back at a night it never truly forgot. Louisa's life, her world, her routines, and why she mattered. Before we walk into the crime, we need to walk into Louisa's life. Because if we don't, she becomes what offenders always try to turn people into. A faceless target, a footnote, a statistic. Louisa Dunn was born in 1892. Think about what that means. She lived through times that would reshape the entire world. Decades that made and broke governments, changed cities, changed families. And as a young woman, she wasn't simply watching history happen from a distance. In court, the judge described her as being involved in the birth of the labor movement, part of a mission to improve life for ordinary working people. This is not the description of someone who drifted through life. It's the description of someone with conviction. Someone who believed people deserved better and, in her own way, tried to push the world toward it. Louisa was married twice. Her first husband was Edward Parker, a notable figure in Bristol, described as an alderman and a leading light in the Labour Party. He died in 1945. Louisa and Edward had two daughters, Iris and Edna. And here's a detail that makes Louisa feel tangible, like someone you could picture in a room. Louisa's granddaughter, Mary Dainton, later recalled being told that Louisa and Edward's home was a hub of social and political activity. Not the glamorous kind, the real kind. People at a table, teacups, papers, voices, debates, a house that didn't just shelter a family, it hosted a purpose. That's a different kind of legacy than most people leave behind. After Edward's death and some years later, Louisa remarried. Her second husband was John Dunn, a widower from Ireland who worked as a night watchman for the Bristol Corporation. He died about 6 years before 1967. So, by the time we reach the late 1960s, Louisa is living alone. And she's not a young widow, not a middle-aged widow. She is an elderly woman in her 70s, holding on to the kind of independence that many people quietly admire. She kept her home, kept her routines, kept her place in the neighborhood. She lived at 58 Britannia Road in Easton, Bristol, a house she had lived in for many years. And in the judge's words, Louisa led a simple life. She was supported by her old age pension and supplementary allowance. She didn't keep money in the house. She didn't have valuables. Her treasured possessions were her books and the deeds to her home. That small line about the deeds matters more than it seems, because the deeds mean belonging. It means this house wasn't just where she stayed. It was hers. It represented a life built and held together across decades. And when people talk about victim vulnerability, it's easy to reduce that to age and physicality. The judge did describe her as a small, elderly woman living alone. But vulnerability is also something else. It's predictability. It's routine. It's a life that doesn't contain the kinds of defenses a younger or wealthier person might have. Louisa didn't live behind layers of locks and alarms. She lived behind habit, familiarity, and community. And she had that community. The judge described her friendships and routines in Easton. Her best friend of around 30 years was Alice Clark, also a widow, also living in the area. Alice had reduced mobility, and Louisa would visit her at least once a week, usually in the early evening. On the evening of the 27th of June, 1967, Louisa visited Alice from about 5:20 p.m. She left in good spirits, saying she would go home to bed. That is the last time she is described as herself. A friend, a neighbor, a woman finishing a visit and heading home for the night. Alice believed Louisa didn't have many other close friends, but said something that says everything about a street like Britannia Road. A few close neighbors would go in to see she was all right. Louisa was known. She was checked on. This wasn't isolation in the modern sense. It was a quieter life, threaded into the lives next door. One neighbor, Kathleen Haynes, had known Louisa well for about 30 years and always spoke to her in the street. Another neighbor, Violet Fortune, lived next door at number 60 and had been her neighbor since 1957, describing Louisa as always being a good neighbor. And Violet and Louisa had a routine, the kind of routine that only exists when people actually care. Violet would leave the previous day's newspaper on Louisa's front garden wall each morning. If you wanted to understand how this crime shook the street, understand this. When you leave a newspaper on someone's wall every morning, you notice if it stays there. You notice if the door doesn't open. You notice if the street's usual rhythm misses a beat. Now, decades later, Louisa's granddaughter, Mary Dayton, would speak about what it meant to be a family living with a cold case. Mary described that Louise's brutal rape and murder left her mother very ill, to the extent she never recovered, and that the crime clouded the rest of her life, and the lives of other family members too. Mary also spoke about the stigma attached to rape and murder, people withdrawing from the family, forcing her to suppress emotions for decades. This is the part of cold cases people forget. The crime happens once, but the aftermath keeps happening. Year after year, generation after generation, because there is no ending, no verdict, no line drawn under the story, just a question mark. And that's what Louise's family lived with for 58 years. The first wrong thing. Now we move into the morning of 28th June, 1967. On that street, the day begins like any other day begins. Doors opening, curtains shifting, a sense of who belongs where. But there's a quiet absence that starts to stand out. Louisa hasn't been seen, and then it's the window. The judge later described the collective concern of neighbors that morning. Louisa hadn't been seen, and her window was unusually open. Imagine the thinking that happened in those first minutes. At first, people reach for comforting explanations. Maybe she slept in. Maybe she felt unwell. Maybe she went to the shop early. But the comforting explanations don't fit the way the street knows Louisa. The concerns grow. And eventually someone makes a choice. Not a dramatic choice, but the kind that changes your life in the quietest way. A neighbor goes inside. Louisa is found dead in her home. The Crown Prosecution Service later confirmed she was found dead at her home on Britannia Road and that she had been raped and died of strangulation and asphyxiation. In court, the judge spoke directly to the offender. "You broke into her home, you sexually assaulted her, and in doing so, you caused her death." And the street that had been built on routines and familiarity is suddenly split into a before and after. Because once you know someone can come into an elderly woman's home at night and do that, then every home is re-evaluated. Every window is re-seen. Every quiet street becomes a place where, at the back of your mind, you start counting the ways you might not be safe. Police in 1967 did what they could with what they had. A palm print was found on an upstairs bedroom window. Evidence of someone trying to gain entry through a window. And that palm print mattered so much that it triggered one of the most extraordinary efforts you can imagine. Police took palm prints from more than 19,000 men during the original investigation, trying to identify who had left it. 19,000 men. That is the scale of a city searching its own face for a monster. And yet, even with that scale, no match, no arrest, no ending. As months pass, then years, the case changes form. It stops being something you can solve with urgency and becomes something you carry. For Louise's family, it becomes a weight that sits in the background of every milestone. For neighbors, it becomes a story that resurfaces in quiet moments, and the community's memory remains. Because in places like this, people don't forget what happened on their street. The judge later described the impact as enduring, devastating, and intergenerational, and noted that the fact the crime was unsolved and the offender remained at large for so long compounded the family's suffering. In 1967, rape was not spoken about the way it is now, and rape against an elderly woman carried an ugly social stigma that could isolate families further, not only because of grief, but because of the reactions of other people. That stigma appears in Mary Dainton's words, repeated in the judge's remarks. People withdrew from her family, forcing her to suppress emotions for decades. A crime can take a life. And then, if the community responds with withdrawal, it can take a family's sense of belonging too. The case might have stayed cold forever, but in 2023, Avon and Somerset Police began a re-review of the investigation through their major crime review team. This is the moment where the story shifts from memory to possibility. Because re-review means asking a new question. What physical evidence still exists, preserved from 1967, that modern forensics can now examine? Police later confirmed that items were submitted for forensic analysis, including clothing, and that Louise's blue skirt, which she was wearing at the time she was attacked, was among the items tested. A skirt, folded away for decades, waiting for the world to catch up. Did you know why cold case evidence can suddenly speak? DNA doesn't become stronger with time. Comparison becomes possible with time. A sample can sit for decades without a match until the right person's DNA enters a database, or until testing methods improve enough to extract a usable profile. In this case, police said Headley's DNA profile was placed onto the national system in 2012 following an unrelated incident which created the possibility of a later match. The fact that reframes the entire story. When the forensic results came back, they didn't offer a new theory. They offered a name. The examination of Louise's blue skirt produced a full DNA profile. That profile was compared to the national database and matched Ryland Headley. The court was told the DNA was a billion to one times more likely to be from Headley than anyone else. And then something even more chilling clicked into place. After Headley was taken into custody and new prints were taken from him, the palm print found on the upstairs bedroom window in Louise's home was also found to match him. That palm print, that one that led police to take prints from 19,000 men in 1967, had belonged to him all along. The case stopped being a mystery about what kind of person could do this. It became a case about how a specific person did it and how he lived his life after. So this is where this story, the past and the present, collide. Because once you have a match, once you have Ryland Headley, the investigation becomes a kind of time travel. You have to prove with documents and records and preserved evidence that this man was in the right place at the right time with no plausible alternative explanation. Police described how the re-investigation involved reviewing 20 boxes of original material. A Guardian feature later described the reality of that work. Opening boxes, finding items that had not been subjected to modern forensic examination, rebagging and submitting them for DNA testing, and persisting through doubt until a profile was returned that finally pointed to a suspect. That's the unglamorous heroism of cold case work. Paper, dust, patience. And the willingness to treat an elderly woman's death in 1967 as something that still deserves effort in 2023 and 2024. Now we need to talk about the offender, carefully. Not to center him, not to mythologize him, but to explain the shape of the danger that entered Louise's life. None of my cases will ever, ever glamorize the killer in any light. The person who is killed will always be the spotlight, and the darkness is where those killers will remain. Ryan Headley was living in Bristol at the time of the murder, according to CPS. By the time of his conviction, he was living in Ipswich, and police gave his address as Clarence Road. And what made the identification even darker is this.
The court heard evidence about his subsequent criminal conduct, specifically rapes and burglaries in later years, involving invasions of elderly women's homes and sexual assaults. The judge said that those offences revealed a chilling pattern of behaviour. Police also stated that Headley had been convicted of two counts of rape in the late 1970s after attacking elderly women in Ipswich by breaking into their home overnight and threatening them with violence. They said both offences happened in October 1977, with one victim in her late 70s and the other in her mid-80s. This is one of the hardest truths to sit with in this story. Louisa wasn't attacked by a one-time offender who vanished and never harmed again. The documented information presented in court and by police indicates a history of targeting elderly women in their homes. And then you find yourself asking the question that everyone asks when a cold case is solved this late. How do we get away with Louisa's murder for nearly 60 years? Police gave a blunt piece of context. Headley never featured in the original 1967 investigation because he lived outside the area where the house-to-house inquiries were carried out. Sometimes a predator doesn't escape justice because he's brilliant. Sometimes he escapes because he falls into the gaps. The lines drawn by geography, by limited information, by what police could reasonably reach at the time. And then decades later, science closes that gap. Now the story shifts into present tense. Police said Headley was arrested on the 19th of November 2024 at his Ipswich home, taken into custody, interviewed, charged, and remanded. The CPS said he had been remanded since his arrest in November 2024. The case that had lived in archives now lived in courtrooms. And this is another cruel detail of cold cases. Due to the time that had passed, most witnesses were no longer alive. The CPS said all but one trial witness had died, meaning the prosecution had to rely on written accounts from witnesses at the time. So the evidence had to do the speaking. DNA, a palm print, and records. And in sentencing, the judge acknowledged the statement of two later victims, described as KB and LB, read in court. Statements that, in the judge's words, brought home to everyone who heard them what Louisa must have endured. Those statements weren't used to turn later crimes into extra punishment. For Louisa's case, the judge explicitly noted they could not aggravate the offences for which he was sentencing Headley. But they did something else. They stripped away the comfort of imagining this as a one-off, inexplicable event. They showed a pattern that made Louisa's case feel less like a random lightning strike and more like a predator doing what predators do, choosing a vulnerable target in a vulnerable place. And through it all, the story keeps returning to Louisa because courtrooms can do something families have been waiting decades to hear. They can say the victim's name out loud in the present tense. The judge began sentencing by saying he wanted to speak about the woman you killed. He spoke about her life, her history, her marriage, her children, her friendships, her routines, her simplicity. Because even at sentencing, the point was to bring Louisa back into the courtroom. That is, in its own quiet way, a restoration. Did you know why beyond reasonable doubt still applies in cold cases? A jury doesn't need to know every detail of an old case to convict. They need to be sure there is no reasonable alternative explanation for the court facts. In historic trials where witnesses are gone, physical evidence like DNA and fingerprints often become central because it doesn't rely on memory. In this case, both the DNA and palm print evidence were described publicly by the police and prosecutors as compelling proof linking Headley to the crime. The verdict and sentencing. The trial took place at Bristol's Crown Court in June 2025. Headley denied the offences, but the jury found him guilty. Police stated the jury unanimously found him guilty of rape and found him guilty of murder by a majority of 10 to 2. The conviction date is clear. 30th of June 2025, just this year. And then came sentencing on the 1st of July 2025. The judge imposed life imprisonment and set a minimum term of 20 years, noting that under current law, the court had to set a minimum term but also had to consider what tariff would have been imposed under the early sentencing regime. Then, in the starkest possible language, the judge told Headley that given his age, he would never be released. He would die in prison. The case that had once been a window left open on a summer morning finally reached an ending that could be spoken aloud. Guilty, sentenced, accountable. If you've never lived near a street where something terrible happened, it can be hard to understand how long a place can carry a memory. But in Bristol, police stated that there are people living in the city today who remember the impact this crime had back in 1967. And for Louise's family, the aftermath was never a single event. It was a long, cumulative erosion. The judge described Mary Dainton's account, how Louise's rape and murder left Mary's mother very ill, never truly recovering, how the crime clouded her life and the lives of other family members, how the fact it remained unsolved for so long compounded their suffering. Then there is the strange secondary trauma that can happen when a cold case suddenly heats up again. After decades of holding pain in silence, the arrest and the trial drag everything back into daylight. Mary described feeling sad and very tired, and spoke of the sorrow that so many people who knew and loved Louisa weren't alive to see justice finally done. That is the cruel paradox of cold case justice. It brings closure, and it also forces the family to reopen grief they've had to learn to live around. There's another aftermath too. The investigative ripple. When a cold case is solved by DNA and historical review, it encourages police forces to ask how many other old cases still have evidence that might speak today. A Guardian report described how the review team continued working through many other cold cases after this breakthrough. It's not just a solved crime. It's a statement of possibility. A warning to offenders who believe time makes them invisible. And a promise to families who have lived decades inside a question mark. I would argue that time has changed its side. Of who it supports. It isn't a matter of if with today's technology. It is a matter of when. And I am personally emboldened and strengthened by the thought that all these cold cases will be busted open so we can kick down the door of these criminals hiding behind the shadows of time. Louisa Dunn did not live a flashy life. She lived a rooted life, a life of routine and community, a life where a neighbor left yesterday's newspaper on her garden wall each morning, not because it was required, but because it was neighborly. And the morning that newspaper routine failed, the morning Louisa wasn't seen, the morning the window was open, the street understood. Before anyone said it out aloud, that something had broken. The man who did it likely believed the same thing many offenders believe, that time would protect him, and for decades it did. Until the world learned how to read the past and DNA profiling from a skirt and palm print on a window, and turn those silent traces into a name. And then in the end, the most dramatic part of the whole story isn't a chase scene. It's a knock on a door in 2024 for a crime committed in 1967. Louisa's life was taken in one night, but her name lasted. And when justice finally arrived, it arrived carrying the proof that she was never just a case file. She was a person and she mattered. And that is where we leave the Bristol cold case. Because no matter how much time passes, there's something uniquely haunting about a quiet home on a quiet street. About a woman who did everything right, lived gently, lived steadily, lived kindly, and still had her safety stolen in the most unthinkable way. Louisa Dunn wasn't a headline in her own life. She was a neighbour, a friend, a familiar face on a familiar road. Someone whose world was made of ordinary rituals. Visiting her best friend, going home to bed, being part of the street's rhythm. And the fact it took nearly 6 decades to name the person responsible doesn't make what happened any less awful. But it does make one thing clear. Time doesn't erase truth. Sometimes it just delays it. And brings hope to all cold cases in 2025 and onwards. And when the truth finally arrives, it doesn't come with fireworks, oh no. It comes with evidence that never stops speaking, quietly, patiently, waiting for the world to finally understand its language. If you've made it this far with me, thank you for listening with your full heart. I'm your tale teller, and this has been Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales, where we step into the dark with respect, we hold space for the victims, and we tell these stories the way they deserve to be told, carefully, truthfully, and with humanity intact. If you want more episodes, more mysteries, more shadows, more strange corners of the world where truth and terror overlap, you can find Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, share an episode with someone who loves a good chill down the spine, leave a review, or just keep coming back. That alone means more than you know. Now, before we go, I want to do my favorite part. The people who help keep this candle lit. The ones standing at the edge of the woods with me, holding the lantern, making sure the story gets told. First, my absolute legend of legends, my friend, my old night tea titan, Matto Star.
Matto Star!
Matto, you magnificent, architectural, baroque-loving titan of the night, thank you. You're the kind of supporter and friend who feels less like a patron and more like a trusted companion walking beside me through every corridor of every haunted house I ever narrate. When the story gets heavy, when the details turn grim, you're one of the names I think of as proof that this show has real people behind it. People with heart, taste, and that beautifully dramatic appreciation for the grand and the gothic. You're the steady note underneath the melody, mate, and I am genuinely grateful for you. Thank you, Matto Star. Have a wonderful, wonderful week ahead. And into the new year as well, no less. And thank you for your never-ending, genuine support. You are a fantastic friend of mine. And now to my white tea warlords. I am lucky to have Lezasaurus Rex. Leza, my gym-powered, iron-willed warlord. Thank you for showing up with the energy of someone who could physically suplex a demon and then casually wipe their hands and ask, "All right, Teller, what's next?" Your support is pure momentum. It's the steady thump of footsteps behind me in the dark. The feeling that I'm not walking alone. I appreciate you more than I can say, my friend. Thank you so much, Leza. Have a wonderful week and a fantastic new year as well. My next white tea warlord, Maya. Maya, queen of cats, ruler of soft paws and sharp instincts. Thank you. You have that perfect blend of warmth and watchfulness, like a cat sitting in the doorway of a haunted room going, "I'll let you in, but I'm watching the shadows for you." Your support feels like comfort with claws, gentle, loyal, and absolutely not to be messed with. I'm so grateful you're here. Thank you, Maya, for your ongoing support throughout the years. Just like my White Tea Warlords and Old Night Tea Titans and my Old Grain Forces, I am jaw-droppingly appreciative of your friendship and support, Maya, and have a fantastic new year yourself. And to my final white tea warlord, Sangeetha, the seer. The one who already knows the twist before the narrator even clears their throat. Thank you. Your presence in this community feels like an extra sense, Sangeetha. Like we've got someone standing just outside the frame, quietly noticing what everyone else misses. You bring this calm, wise energy that makes the whole space feel protected. I appreciate you deeply, Sangeetha. Thank you very, very much. Have a wonderful week ahead and a brilliant New Year celebration. Again, to Matto Star, Lezasaurus, Maya and Sangeetha, thank you for helping Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales keep breathing. Thank you for being part of this strange little campfire in the dark. And thank you genuinely for trusting me, your tale-teller, with these stories. And a huge thank you in kind to my old grey enforcers and all tiers thereafter. I am exceptionally lucky to have Chad Warren, Peter Raffaelli, Just Heather, Juicebox Andy, Divided by Zero, Age Kramer, Seductive Smiles, Jane Gumnick, and Michael Krupp. Thank you so much, my O-Grain forces and all tiers thereafter. If you want to support this podcast, you can hop on over to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/SFGT. I've made a distinctive shift into true crime because I'm passionate about it and it interests me so, so much. So expect to see a big shift this new year. I'm also working on a new way to present the stories via YouTube. So if you want to visit my YouTube channel, you absolutely can. You can also catch me on Spotify, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, Audioboom, pretty much everywhere and anywhere. And I'll put the links in the show notes so you don't have to go hunting. But for all of you amazing, amazing souls listening, and for all of my legendary friends supporting me on Patreon, thank you for a fantastic and amazing, amazing year. Next year is going to be really big. I've got a lot of things in motion and a lot of new creative ventures in mind. I've been doing this show for like maybe 12 years plus now, and I love every single minute that I'm on it. And the chance to share stories with you, and now the chance to share true crime, respectfully, of course, with all my friends online, and with you lovely listeners, I am going to hit the ground running next year. But I just want to say thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for hanging out with me. If you have any stories of your own, please submit them to storiesfablesghostlytales@gmail.com. If you have any true crime cases in your local area or ones you want me to cover as well, please do the same. Email me, leave a comment in Patreon, leave a comment in the YouTube comment section as well. I read every single one. Trust me, I do, and I love it. So please don't be a stranger, legends. All right, mates, have a fantastic New Year's break. My love goes out to you. Take care of yourself. Be safe. Check on your friends. Check on your neighbors. And I'll see you in the next true crime case. Love you all so, so much. And happy New Year.
In a small town where the streetlights blink like tired eyes, a door clicks shut and the silence begins that takes decades to answer. Louisa Dunn, a name the years tried to bury in dust. But names don't die when people still speak them. They just wait, like letters never opened, like a clock that keeps time in a locked room. There was a night in 67, ordinary as a kettle cooling on the stove until it wasn't. Stayed pinned to the moment.
So we follow the shadows, not for thrills, not for fame, but to bring back the light to a life with a name. Louisa, we remember you. Through the static, through the rain. That live like ghosts in a filing cabinet, paper bones, ink veins.
its truth held together by staples and hope. A witness line fades, a lead goes cold, the town learns to step around the ache. But time is not mercy, time is just distance, and distance doesn't erase what happened. It only hides the footprints. So we follow the shadows, not for thrills, not for fame, but to bring back the light to a life with a name. Louisa, we remember you. Through the static, through the rain. Fifty-eight long years of questions, and we still say your name. Evidence waits, truth waits, and somewhere the past keeps knocking, soft at first, then louder, until someone finally answers the door. They say the years can swallow anything, but they never swallow a mother's prayer. Never swallow a sister's rage, never swallow the quiet courage of not yet. Keep looking. And when the world calls it history, the ones left behind call it. White tea warlords and friends of mine. Lesosaurus, my gym genius. Maya, my queen of cats. And Sanjitha, the seer that sees all. And to all my Earl Grey.